After hundreds of interviews and thousands of hours of research, we're excited to share with you our first book, The Greater Good, Life Lessons from Hawaii's Leaders, with a special foreword from Mayor Mufi Hanneman.
The Greater Good is a collection of personal stories and quotes from over 70 of the leaders we've interviewed.
The Greater Good will make you laugh, make you cry, and will inspire you to live a greater good life.
Available at bookstores statewide and at greatergoodbooks.com.
Welcome to Greater Good Radio Hawaii, where leaders inspire leaders. Greater Good Radio Hawaii is dedicated to social entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Evan Leong, and with me is my co-host, Carrie Leong.
Mahalo, Evan. Today's guest is Dick Gushman, CEO of DGM Group, a diversified real estate company. Dick is a trustee of the estate of James Campbell and managing partner of Summit Financial Resources. Please welcome to Greater Good Radio, Richard Dick Gushman. Welcome to our show, Dick.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
So can you explain to us what diversified real estate is?
Yeah, we have a portfolio of real estate that involves high-rise office buildings, downtown and central business district, retail projects both here in Hawaii and out of the state, rental multifamily apartment buildings here in Honolulu and over the past, industrial, single-family, all kinds of real estate classes.
So on your bio we're looking at, I mean, you're doing everything from board of trustees for American Savings Bank and then the Hawaii Pacific University, as well as a number of nonprofits. How did you get involved and get a start in business?
I came here in 1971 as a merchant seaman on a marine research ship, and I thought it didn't look at all like Ohio in the middle of the winter, which is where I came from. So in 1972, I came back with my then wife and started in business here through the real estate licensing process, and went to work for the McCormick Corporation back in 1972. Perhaps one of your previous guests, Duncan McNaughton, was my boss. And over time, I left, started my own company in 1973, and Duncan joined me in 1975 on the thesis that if I could do it, anyone could. So he left, and we started it together at that time.
And then your guys' projects from there, because I know everybody, once they hear it, will know about it. What did you guys start with in the progression?
Well, the first projects we built were very small, and they progressively got larger and more complicated as we had more access to capital. We had more reputational leverage, and the largest project that we built together was the Waikele Center out in the Pahu Waikele area.
How old were you guys at the time?
When I started my own company, I was 27. Duncan joined me when I was 30, and he was 32.
What made you get into real estate at that time?
I came from a real estate family. My father's a real estate developer and a contractor. My mother was a trained architect, so I was sandwiched into this business as a kid. So I came out here with a pregnant wife to get into the marine field, and the morning after I arrived, the company I was going to go to work for filed bankruptcy. And so I went through a career change the next day and went back to the real estate business, which I had some working familiarity with.
So what were you thinking when that business went under? What were you thinking at the time?
I was thinking what I could tell my wife, who was in bed with morning sickness, how I could elegantly lie to her about the fact that we didn't have a job, but we had a child on the way, and we had just gotten here the day before. So I had a really narrow idea of what I was thinking about, Evan.
What were the steps then you took at that point? Did you go through the newspaper? You knocked on someone's door? What happened?
All of that. I started going through the process of trying to find contacts to people who were in the business. I was very fortunate because that was at a time when Hawaii was in one of its up cycles, and people were really active in the real estate industry. So eventually it led me to go through a process to the McCormick Corporation, where I joined them as a project manager and worked there for 9 months and quit and went on my own.
How'd you know you could go on your own? I mean, you just had a feeling. How'd you get the confidence to know that?
Well, I'm not sure that confidence and stupidity should be confused with one another. It was probably a personality thing. I wasn't a great employee. I think I was more comfortable failing on my own as opposed to succeeding in a more collegial corporate environment. So I found a little project, a little tiny office building, some people here who had owned the land, local couples, and some of their friends took a chance because I had no credentials and I'd been here for about 12 months and I was 27 years old. So,
how'd you convince these people to go into business with you after 9 months?
It was, you know, I think at the end of the day, being just straightforward is probably the best path to wherever you're headed. And I was convinced it would be successful, and I was apparently able to share my enthusiasms with them. And they put the land into the equation, and I put the rest of the financing and what have you together, and off we went.
So you mentioned that the market was good when you started. How long was it till the market didn't do so well, and how did you deal with that?
I've been in the business now for 35 years, and I've been through three complete cycles, so I think I've seen the insides and outsides of the changing nature of business in real estate as an industry. It has historically been a very cyclical business, and I've been fortunate to have been in positions in each of the cycles where the cycle didn't kill me. Some of them were less fun than others. The one thing to remember about the real estate business, and I think this is probably true for a lot of industries and businesses, that down cycles are extremely opportunistic times. Big money is made on the downside, not on the upside. The upside is when you sell what you bought on the downside. And so the trick is to survive the downside so you can be a seller on the upside.
Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned for more on Greater Good Radio.
After hundreds of interviews and thousands of hours of research, we're excited to share with you our first book, The Greater Good, Life Lessons from Hawaii's Leaders, with a special foreword from Mayor Mufi Hanneman.
The Greater Good is a collection of personal stories and quotes from over 70 of the leaders we've interviewed.
The Greater Good will make you laugh, make you cry, and will inspire you to live a greater good life.
Available at bookstores statewide and at greatergoodbooks.com.
Howdy sell his company to Akamai Technologies for $3 billion.
Find out at greatergoodradio.com.
Who donates 6% of sales to make more money?
Find out at greatergoodradio.com.
How do you get 100 stores and 100 million in sales in less than 10 years?
Find out at greatergoodradio.com.
Who raised $50,000 in a few weeks for the tsunami relief?
Find out at greatergoodradio.com.
And all while benefiting the community.
GreaterGoodRadio.com.
You're listening to Greater Good Radio Hawaii. Please visit us online at GreaterGoodRadio.com. Today's guest is Dick Gushman, CEO of DGM Group and Director of Oceanic Cable Vision, Surfco Pacific, and Outrigger Enterprises.
Where'd the name DGM Group come from?
Well, when I started a management company in the late 80s, we were building a portfolio of office building assets. We needed a name for that company, and I came back to work one day, and the woman who was the president of that company said that she had gotten employees together, and they had decided on naming the company DGM Group. And I thought, wow, that's very flattering, Dick Gushman Management. She said, no, it's damn good management. So I got voted off the island right at the beginning of the business.
So can you give advice to people out there that are looking at real estate? And now you have so many speculators and people are making money, almost like the stock market in the 90s. You know, what do you see in this kind of market?
Well, I think you have to separate the individual investors from the professionals because they're wildly different categories. You know, it's sort of like the same genus but different species. The professionals right now are, I think, managing their assets for longer-term activities. The perhaps the more speculative part of the industry of people who are buying the small incremental portions of real estate that they have access to, homes, condominiums, timeshare units, and those kinds of things, which, you know, for the record, publicly traded securities like REIT shares and things like that, been extremely successful for them after the last two or three years. But like any asset class, it will adjust. So there probably will be some form of mild correction as we go forward in the future. But when it occurs and how deep it is unknown.
So, you know, we were talking a little bit about the downtimes. I guess I was curious about what did you learn from the first cycle of downtime that helped you to be ready for it the second time around?
Good question. I think that real estate's historically all been about leverage. And one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was from a now legendary investor in Texas named Richard Rainwater, who's one of the Forbes 400 guys. And he said he took a job working for a very wealthy family in Texas, and he didn't know exactly what to do. And his first stop, he went to Omaha, Nebraska, and he met with Warren Buffett. And he said, "Warren, what should I do?" And he said, "First rule is don't lose their money." So real estate down cycles are all about risk management, not about upside potential. So a lot of it has to do with how clever you are and how lucky you are in managing the risks against the opportunities, because you can trade one for the other, and hopefully that you've traded well so that you don't have a catastrophic position and you've had to give up some of the upside opportunity to avoid getting totally wiped out when the tsunami comes ashore.
So, you know, you're pretty young, like 27, 30s around this time. Who did you look up to as a mentor that would guide you through these ups and downs and your business advice and how to grow and develop at the same time?
That's a good question. I'm very fortunate that I had a wonderful role model, my father, who was in this business, and a great friend and a mentor. I grew up in the Midwest, so there was this sort of no-nonsense Calvinistic, if you just work harder, you'll probably get better mindset. There were people here in the community who were, I think, very helpful to me, guys like Herb Cornell and, you know, Walter Dodds on some occasions. And I gathered information and inspiration from everybody I could find around me. But at the end of the day, if you're the entrepreneur, if you're the guy in charge, if you're sitting behind a desk, you have to make the call. And that is highly intuitive. It is really not a consensual process. It's a self-digestion process. At the end of the day, you have to close the door and say yes or no. And you're betting your money and your employees' futures and the investment confidence of others who have given you their capital too. So they're big and sometimes kind of lonely decisions.
Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned for more on Greater Good Radio.
After hundreds of interviews and thousands of hours of research, we're excited to share with you our first book, The Greater Good, Life Lessons from Hawaii's Leaders, with a special foreword from Mayor Mufi Hanneman.
The Greater Good is a collection of personal stories and quotes from over 70 of the leaders we've interviewed.
The Greater Good will make you laugh, make you cry, and will inspire you to live a greater good life.
Available at bookstores statewide and at greatergoodbooks.com.
Is the greatest part of your workday the leftover lasagna you packed for lunch? Is it quickly becoming apparent that you and everyone you know are smarter than your boss? Just how satisfying is it to wear an untucked shirt on Fridays? It's time you stopped filling a position and started being fulfilled with a job that excites you every day, not just payday. And now is the perfect time to demand more of the work week. The Honolulu Star Bulletin and Midweek work with Monster so you can live up to your potential right here. Your calling is calling. Find it at starclassifieds.monster.com.
We're back with Dick Gushman, CEO of DGM Group and member of the Board of Trustees of the Estate of James Campbell.
So, Dick, a lot of people don't know this, but I heard you were a football star in college. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Well, I think a star is a wild exaggeration. I played college football for 3 years at a small college in Ohio where I played linebacker. It was a great learning experience for me. It's one of those things that involves teamwork and all that stuff you hear about. So I draw some of my daily disciplines from having that experience.
So tell us, though, what did you learn from it in your daily disciplines? How do you apply that today?
You know, one of the things that sports teaches young people is the intangible, Evan, of making a sacrifice today for a future opportunity that you cannot understand until you've gotten there. But the only way to get there is you have to make the sacrifice. So athletics forces you into to blind confidence that if you work really hard, like somebody's telling you to, the way they tell you to, something good will happen, but it's really uncomfortable while you're doing it. That's sort of the way life turns out to be. So I think it's a pretty good blueprint.
Did you ever have a time in your career where you felt like you were doing the right thing and you actually were doing the right thing when you look back, but just results weren't coming as fast as you thought they should have been coming?
Are you kidding? Absolutely. That happens all the time, and anyone who tells you that's not the case is probably being disingenuous.
So how do you know that you're on the right track?
You don't. That's the scary part. Whenever you're taking big risks, you are there will be times when you have to have unshakable confidence, and sometimes it proves to be mistaken confidence because sometimes you're wrong.
So how does somebody that is, you know, trying to get on this path and get to the next level in terms of their career, their life, their progression, and so on, go from where, you know, they're at to that higher level that, you know, someone like yourself has already basically achieved?
A part of it, and not to be contrite, but part of it, a big part of it, is having the willingness to lose. And that's the major separator. So people who are trying to be or have an interest in being entrepreneurial, to start something, for a lot of people, most for very, very legitimate reasons, like they can't feed their families or take care of their obligations, if you're not willing to lose it all, at some point, that, I believe, separates the really great entrepreneurs, which I don't necessarily qualify myself as one, from others, because you have to be willing to believe in your own self-confidence, because there's no roadmap. Believe me, when Duncan and I built Wykele, I can't tell you how many people that both of us were seeing every day who said, you're going to build a 750,000-square-foot shopping center in a sugarcane field in Waipahu. You cannot believe how many of my closest friends were kind enough not to tell me how stupid they thought that was. But they told me afterwards. So you just have to believe that you can stand in the middle of a cane field and tell somebody it'd be a great place to put a big store.
And then there's actually a component on the other side, though, because on one side you're willing to lose it and you got the confidence. On the other side, you got to be putting in time, effort. What else do you have to be putting in to make sure that it balances, right? You know, that the odds are in your favor.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, the only ingredient that you have to fall back on is your own confidence. Because at some point in every project, you will come to a tipping place where it challenges your courage. And sometimes you're wrong. And you just have to be lucky enough or skillful enough to live through the wrong decisions and hope that you make more right ones that are larger than the wrong ones to be able to, you know, continue at what you're trying.
So how would you deal with something if you do get into a situation to lose? How did you do it the first time, and how did you pull yourself out?
It's a very destabilizing thing for high-achievement people, and particularly when you think that you know the answers and you've been more right than wrong, and then you have a train wreck, and you have to really deal with the fact that you're not either immortal or immune from bad decisions, and pick up your pieces in the confidence and go on and make another decision and live with it.
So do you think you should always have a plan B or a plan C?
No, I don't. I think that those are made up on the fly, because you cannot, when something goes wrong in a major undertaking, you can't predict how to get out of it, because the circumstances in which it's going on and the conditions that created the mishap are unpredictable. And then when you get there, you have to work just as hard at unwinding an unsuccessful thing as you have to be creative and successful. And so it takes time, it takes a lot of energy, and it takes a lot of your emotional resources. And so managing the downside is just as important as managing the upside. We can all manage the upside. It's really easy. You know, when things are going great, it doesn't take as much much stamina.
What would you do if you weren't doing real estate?
It's a very good question. There's a, and I've been in the business world for 35 years, and there are times when I now, having reached the age of 60 recently, I look at the rest of the universe, about which I have various curiosities, and think about things that I would be interested in doing more of. But I must confess that I'm a serial killer when it comes to entrepreneurial opportunities, so I made my peace with that, Evan, a long time ago, so I'm pretty comfortable staying in the batter's box for a while.
Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned for more on Greater Good Radio.
After hundreds of interviews and thousands of hours of research, we're excited to share with you our first book, The Greater Good, Life Lessons from Hawaii's Leaders, with a special foreword from Mayor Mufi Hanneman.
The Greater Good is a collection of personal stories and quotes from over 70 of the leaders we've interviewed.
The Greater Good will make you laugh, make you cry, and will inspire you to live a greater good life.
Available at bookstores statewide and at greatergoodbooks.com.
Neptune ice, we're feeling fine. We're staying cool on Hawaiian time. Neptune ice, it's sunshine in your mouth.
For bubble tea supplies in your home, at a party, or business, contact Bubble Tea Supply at 948-2622 or online at bubbletea.com.
Neptune ice, it's sunshine in your mouth.
How do you sell his company to Akamai Technologies for $3 billion?
Find out at greatergoodradio.com.
Who donates 6% of sales to make more money?
Find out at greatergoodradio.com.
How do you get 100 stores and 100 million in sales in less than 10 years?
Find out at greatergoodradio.com.
Who raised $50,000 in a few weeks for the tsunami relief?
Find out at greatergoodradio.com.
And all while benefiting the community.
GreaterGoodRadio.com.
You're listening to Greater Good Radio Hawaii. Please visit us online at greatergoodradio.com. Today's guest is Dick Gushman, CEO of DGM Group, Director of Oceanic Cablevision, and a trustee of the estate of James Campbell. Dick also supports the Aloha United Way, Boys and Girls Club of Honolulu, and is a trustee of Hawaii Pacific University. Before break, Dick, you had mentioned something about a tipping point. Are you able to share with us or reflect upon a tipping point in your career?
I'm not sure I could point to a given moment that would be adequate to capture that, although this anecdote I would say is more pointed to your younger audience, but not necessarily age-specific. When you decide to take a bet, and your bet involves your family, their well-being, you get to really keenly focused on the next check because it gets down to whether you're going to be able to make have dinner for your folks. And so when you get past that, I remember when I was my son, who was, for full disclosure, a classmate of Evan's and friends of his, when, you know, he was a year old, I was trying to figure out on paper what I could do to earn $25,000 a year, because I felt if I could do that, I could live forever. And so your perceptions change as you go along.
What is it that makes you change from that? Because Walter Dodd said the same thing. When he was younger, he didn't have any real big aspirations. He thought if he could make 10 grand a year and drive his hot rods, he'd be fine. You know, what is it that makes the change for you guys?
You know, I think that not being able to speak for anyone other than myself, Evan, that for most of us, it's not, as much as this sounds disingenuous, it's not about the money. It's about the process of achieving and succeeding at what you try to do. And if you do that, the money somehow becomes a part of that. So maybe that's the tipping point, being recruited into the answer, because once you get to a point where you're not frightened about survival, then the immediacy of that goes away and you become more and more focused on the task and the opportunities and the process. And that's what keeps me coming back. I'm endlessly interested to see if that big thing we're building down in Waikiki right now will actually work, you know, because it was a blank piece of paper and a bunch of old junky buildings, and we'll see if it works or not, right? So it's always a thrill to figure it out.
Your work schedule per week throughout your career has probably been much more than the average 40 hours, right?
I would say that's a very safe.
How are you fitting in all these nonprofit and your community leadership roles, and then where does that fit into the business?
I was blessed by having community active parents when I was young growing up. My mother's very active, in particular in the United Way. And so I have come from an environment of feeling it was an inherent obligation, and I still feel very strongly about that. I began to try to serve the community when I passed that tipping point, Gary, of not worrying about lunch and dinner, and I still feel very passionate about trying to be a part of the community in which we live. These communities do not take care of themselves. They're cared for by those who live in them, and I get way more out of it than I give to it, both in time and in other ways. It creates perspective on the rest of the activities that I do in my professional life, I think it's greatly rewarding to me, and it's essential for the leadership of any community to not only lead at the financial side, but lead in the community resources side.
So do you have any regrets for maybe putting that on hold till you were at that tipping point? Do you wish that you maybe got involved with the community a little earlier and gone up the path the same time?
It didn't the lag wasn't very long, so we're only talking about really a few years. And I would have to say I don't think I could have done both at that interval, but I would have probably been a little more balanced if I had done that.
Where are you seeing the balance between the two, your community service work, your nonprofit work, and then your business work? And are there overlapping benefits from both?
Absolutely. They're impossible to separate the two because, you know, we live and work in the communities that we all occupy, and you have to be aware of all of the components of a community to see both the risks and the opportunities holistically. So if you want to see it in the round, having a deep involvement in the community certainly assists in that. It's also a great way to get to know people on a non-business basis. So you're sitting on boards in committees working with people you would not otherwise get to see. I met a lot of my now longtime friends who are in the labor side of the world on the United Way board. And I mean, I used to, you know, we have natural and antagonism between management and labor. That's the wrong term, but you're just structurally on different sides of the table. But then you get into a nonprofit and you're sitting on the same side and you see each other differently, you get to know one another differently. And it's a very intimate experience I think incredibly valuable.
Thanks for joining us today on Greater Good Radio. For more information or a transcript of today's show, please visit us online at greatergoodradio.com. This is your host, Evan Leong and Carrie Leong, saying please join us next time for another episode of Greater Good Radio Hawaii.